When Helen and I got married 36 years ago, the minister who preached and who married us and who preached at the service, we asked him to preach on Ephesians chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. And those words go like this: "Be imitators of God, therefore, as dearly loved children, and live a life of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God." And we've tried to have those words at the centre of our marriage and at the centre of our family life. Sometimes we can read those words and overlook what comes immediately preceding those words because they're at the end of the preceding chapter. And so I want to read those words again with the words at the end of the preceding chapter resounding in our ears. And this is what it says: "Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you. Be imitators of God, therefore, as dearly loved children, and live a life of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God." And so as we're to be imitators of God, we've just been told that we're to forgive one another as in Christ God has forgiven us. Foremost in our minds ought to be that we imitate God in the fact that God is a forgiving God. And that forgiveness, which is at the very heart of the gospel, should be at the very heart of our marriage and be at the very heart of our family life. And there have been many times in the last 36 years when I have had to ask for Helen's forgiveness, and there have been times, not as many, where she has asked for my forgiveness. And the challenge, if you're in the previous session in this room, the challenge, of course, is making that forgiveness a reality in our relationships. I know that I'm speaking to a bunch of guys here this afternoon who want nothing more than the very best in their marriage and the very best in their family life. And as you want the very best, you want nothing more than that you and your wife are walking together in relationship with Jesus, and that each of your children, each of your family members, are walking in relationship with Jesus. Hardly an hour of the day will go by without you thinking about those sorts of issues, no matter what other things are preoccupying your mind at any given time. We want to leave a legacy, and as Christian men, we want to leave a spiritual legacy. Let me tell you a couple of stories about the kind of legacies that people leave. There was a man who was about to die, and he was a very, very old age. He lived to about 104, and his children and his grandchildren and his great-grandchildren and his great-great-grandchildren all gathered in the hospital to say goodbye to Grand Poppy. And so one wave after another of these descendants, one generation after another, exhausted this very frail old man, until at the very end of the queue, there was a little four-year-old tacker who climbed up onto the hospital bed and gave his Grand Poppy a hug goodbye. And as he did so, he said, "Grand Poppy, what is the secret to your long life?" Grand Poppy pulled him really close and whispered in his ear, "I never drank, I never smoked, I was always in bed by 10 o'clock every night." And then he pulled him closer and he said, "And every morning for breakfast, I just sprinkled a little gunpowder on my porridge." Well, the little four-year-old was a little stunned by the last bit of advice, but he followed his Grand Poppy's words to the letter, and he outlived his Grand Poppy. He lived to 107, and he left behind a bigger legacy than his Grand Poppy. He left behind 11 children and 38 grandchildren, and 65 great-grandchildren and 98 great-great-grandchildren and a 5-metre crater in the floor of the crematorium. I'd better move on, because the more you imagine that, the more horrid it becomes. What sort of a legacy do we want to leave? I did year 12 at a different school from years 7 to 11. And so this year, 2009, marks the 40th anniversary of the year of 69. And I did years 7 to 11 at Wollongong High School and year 12 at Chatswood High School. I went to my Chatswood High School year 12 reunion a couple of months ago. I had kept up with about two people, and neither of them were going to be there that night. I didn't know a soul, and not a soul knew me. And that was the case for most people who were there with each other. So walking into this room, complete with strangers. We were looking at name tags, and of course then we would remember the person and memories would flood into our mind. I looked at one bloke and I saw his name and I immediately remembered him as the school captain. His name was Lee. He saw my name tag and he immediately remembered me. We'd packed down in the front row of the first 15 at Chatswood High. He was a prop, I was the hooker. He said, "Dave Mansfield, the hooker from hell." I had such a strange look on my face, I think he thought he'd insulted me. And he said, no, it's a compliment, it's a compliment. He said, in that grand final, you won so many scrums against the tight head that it provided the platform for us to go on and win. So I walked around for the rest of the night, 40 years later, about 10 feet tall, not knowing that in those 40 years, I had left that kind of a legacy, at least in his mind. I went to my Wollongong High School reunion as well. One person said, "Dave Mansfield, you were the person that introduced me to following St George." Now, up until last night, I would have been afraid to tell you that. After last night, it takes on a whole new meaning, doesn't it? She also said, "You gave me all your four season CDs," or I think they were called EPs, I think they were, that's right, EPs. And I said, "Well, I can't remember either of those things." Another bloke said, "Dave Mansfield, my parents said to me, whatever you do, keep away from him." And another guy came up to me and he said, "When we were back at high school, you accused me of dobbing you in for putting those fake coins in the pinball machine at the fish shop near the school. I told you then that I didn't dob you in, and I'm telling you again now, it wasn't me." And I thought, this poor bloke's lived for these last 40 years still trying to clear his name. Well, again, what kind of a legacy will we leave those who follow us? What kind of a legacy will we leave our children about how to model their marriage? What kind of a legacy will we leave our children in terms of how to model fatherhood or motherhood in the case of daughters? I want to say from the outset that I have a view of leadership where I believe that my wife and I are equal. We have equal status, but we have a different role in our marriage. And I believe that the New Testament says that I have a role of leadership which is differentiated from my wife's role of leadership. And so I hold a view of male headship. Theologians call it the view of complementarianism. Now, I know that's a hugely long and complicated word, and I'm amazed that I got it out without stumbling over the syllables. That is to say, we are equal, but we have different roles. And my role is to give her leadership in a way that is distinguished from her role to me. I believe that that leadership is to be servant leadership. I believe that that leadership is the leadership where I always act in a way where I consider her needs before my own. Now, on the right of that view, there is a view of authoritarianism. And some people will hold this view in practice, even though they may not hold it in theory. And so it's good not only to hold a view in theory, but in practice as well. The authoritarian view, strictly speaking, says that the male thinks that they are more important than the female. And so the leadership that they will give is a leadership because they are a more important sex. There are those who won't hold that view in theory, but in the practice of their relationship, it will look as if they hold that view. They will make decisions for their family where they really think about what's best for them. So whether it's a view about money, a decision about money, whether it's a decision about career, the primary consideration is themselves rather than their partner and their family. On the left-hand side of the complementarian position, there is a position called the egalitarian position. And in that position, both the male and the female believe that they are equal in status and they are also equal in their roles of leadership. Now, I think there are views further to the right. There's a violent right that you probably see in fundamentalist Islam, and there is a kind of far left position that you probably see in some form of feminism. But probably in this room, the three main views we will share together will be the complementarian position, the authoritarian position on its right, and the egalitarian position on its left. I'm not here this afternoon to argue my position over those other two. I just want you to see that where I stand, and as I read the New Testament, I hold to this position that my wife and I, Helen and I, are equal in status, but I have a role of leadership which is differentiated in some ways from her role. And that role of leadership is that I give servant leadership. That is to say, I always think about what is best for my wife and what is best for our children. One of the New Testament scholars worldwide who has probably championed this position the most is a North American by the name of Wayne Grudem. I had the accidental privilege of having breakfast with Wayne one Saturday morning just before he was about to lead a seminar on these very issues. Wayne Grudem had been on the faculty of Trinity Evangelical Seminary in Illinois, in Chicago, a fairly prestigious seminary in the United States of America. Don Carson is a member of that faculty. Unbeknownst to me, I didn't know that this had happened, he had moved and he had joined a fairly unknown Bible college in Phoenix, Arizona. I'd never heard of the Bible College, and I'd have trouble even placing where Arizona was. Later in the day, we talked about issues of male headship and servant leadership. Later in the day, I discovered at the seminar that the reason why he had moved from this prestigious theological college to a small backwater Bible college was because his wife had sustained some fairly serious injuries in a car accident, and as a part of her recovery, the doctor said it's not in her best interests to be in a cold climate. She needs to be moved to a hot, dry climate. Without question, Wayne Grudem made the call to leave that prestigious, career-enhancing theological facility and move to a small backwater Bible college. That is what I think I'm talking about when I talk about servant leadership seen in its best light. What I'd like to do now is, because I want to make this as practical as I can, I want to share with you a seminar that I have occasionally shared with my son. And I'll explain the ground rules of the seminar. My son's not here today, and so he can't be a part of this seminar with me, but I'm going to try and take his part in the seminar as well. I ought to say and give you a little bit more context. My wife's name is Helen. I think I shared that with you. We've been married for 36 years. We have two daughters and a son. The son is our middle child. The three children are married, and a great joy to us in recent years has been that our older daughter and her husband have had two children, and so 5 years ago we became grandparents, and our son and his wife have one baby daughter. They're always small, aren't they? One small baby seems like a stupid thing to say. Anyway, there you go. About 4 years ago, Jenny, our older daughter, is 33. Steve, our son, is 31. Kim, our younger daughter, is 26. About 4 years ago, I asked Steve if he would share leading a seminar with me. And the ground rule of the seminar, the ground rules went like this. I would share three things that if I had my time over again, I'd do exactly the same way. Steve would then share three things that if we had our family life over again, he would want me to do the same way. Okay? I would then share three things that if I had my time over again, I would do differently. And then the last quarter of the seminar was that Steve would share three things which, if we had our time over again, he would want me to do differently. So you got the ground rules for the seminar? We don't have Steve here, so we don't have two talking heads. You've just got me. And when we first did the seminar, and we've done it a couple of times since, but when we first did it, we didn't tell each other what we were going to say. Now, I now know what Steve said, but when we first did the seminar, I was on tenderhooks because I didn't know what dirt was going to come out. And of course, everyone in the seminar, well, they were just waiting for the last quarter of the match, weren't they? I mean, they just wanted the first 9 points over and done with as quickly as possible so that we could get to the dirt on me, which was the interesting part. So you've got to be patient for the last quarter as well. I'm going to do Steve's part as well as my part. I hope that what I've said so far and what I'm about to say is going to trigger some really good discussion, because I want this to be as practical, as helpful, and I'd like the insights that some of us here might be able to share as well as mine. The first thing that I would do over again is that I think I and Helen and I, and sometimes this will be, I'm sharing Helen's heart as well. We tried to be utterly fair with each of our three children. We tried to make sure that they understood that they were all equally loved and there were no favourites. You need to bear in mind that what we tried to do and their perception of how well we succeeded might be two different things. You also need to understand something about family dynamics, so that we had a child, 18 months later we had a second child, 6 years later we had a third child. Now you might ask, why was there a 6 year gap between two and three? Well, after our second child, Steve, our son, didn't sleep through any night until he was 3 years old, and he didn't sleep consistently through the night until he went to school at the age of five. And so during that time, there was a 5 year period where I think Helen felt that she was entirely submerged, she was drowning, and she would just be able to stick her head up out of the water and take a breath before the next wave would come along and push her under again. They were five very difficult years for us. And they're obviously 5 years in which we thought, we're only having two of these, we're not going for a third one. But when he went to school and started to sleep consistently through the night, we had a moment of weakness and our third one came along. And you need to understand, therefore, that there's a sense in which our third child grew up in a different way to our first two did. And she was still a young teenager when they were virtually adults and off our hands. And that has created some very interesting dynamics and some very interesting perceptions as to the way they think whether we succeeded or failed in terms of equality. So the two older ones think that the younger one got away with stuff that they never got away with. And they're probably right. And the younger one thinks that the two older ones were getting away with stuff that she couldn't get away with because they were older. And she was probably right. And see, we not only had to be as fair as we could, we had to listen to them about how they were perceiving how fair we were being. I think you can probably identify with that in different ways in your family dynamics. The second thing we tried to do was create a kind of, we wanted family life to be like a factory of memories. We deliberately tried to build in as many good memories into family life as we possibly could. Examples of what we did were that we were trigger happy with the camera, and we tried to be trigger happy from the first to the second and to the third. And you know that there's a kind of declension there between the amount of photos you take of the first child through to the third child, and you've probably heard Richard Glover on 702 wax eloquent about that declension. But we tried to take as many photos as we could of the kids, and we tried to have as many photos up on walls in the house as we could of the kids, so that almost wherever they looked, in the public rooms of the house, not their rooms, but wherever they looked in the kitchen, wherever they looked in the family room, there were lots of pictures at lots of different stages of their life. Because we wanted to convey to them that we were proud of them, and we wanted to convey to them that this was a home, this was a family where the parents were proud of the kids. And just seeing their image on walls in lots of different situations was a part of that. Another part of that was that we tried to have good holidays so that we were prepared to go beyond budget and spend a little more than we might otherwise want to spend on holidays, so that we could relive the memories of those holidays. Another example of that was that we tried to make the meal table the centre of activity for the family, so that we not only ate at the meal table, but that we talked as much as possible at the meal table, and we tried to keep the meal table a centre of focus well after we had finished eating. Now, if you remember the film The Castle, you'll remember that Daryl Callaghan speaks, I think it's Daryl, who's the son who narrates the story, says about his father that the meal table's very important, and while they have a meal, the TV has definitely got to be turned down. We, throughout our family life, made sure that the TV was nowhere near the table where we ate, and it wasn't on during the meal, even if it was in a different room. So that the table became a place where we discussed lots and lots of things and tried to keep that discussion going well after the meal finished. Now, I'm not saying this happened 24/7. I'm not saying it happened 7 nights a week. It'd be a lie to give you that impression. For a good number of our years, I was doing itinerant evangelism. And so there were 3 or 4 nights a week when I was out. And so it was very important to make sure that those nights that I were home were very, very important. As a part of this, and this is something I'm so grateful to friends. As a part of this, whenever we invited friends around, we loved it when our friends engaged our kids in conversation over the evening meal. And sometimes we deliberately invited the kinds of friends who could relate well to our kids. And we could see the difference between the friends who didn't engage with our kids and the friends who did, in terms of the speed with which our kids wanted to get away from the table after the meal. And within Christian community life, with the emphasis in the New Testament on hospitality, we've got enormous opportunity to have our wider Christian community sitting around our table, and we sitting around their table. And we've got enormous opportunity for our kids to see Christianity modelled not only in their mum and dad, but also in people in their congregation, in the churches that we belong to. The third thing that I would certainly want to do over again is related to this. We tried not to be legalistic when it came to family devotions. We tried to be flexible, and we tried to be as diverse as we possibly could. And if something wasn't working, we would drop it and we would try something else. If on a particular night there wasn't time to do it for whatever reason, we didn't get hung up about it. And at different stages of the kids' growth, we tried to do different things, whether it was around the table or whether it was over the bedtime story as we kissed them goodnight. And as a part of that flexibility, we tried to encourage open discussion about all sorts of issues. So that when our son Steve was about 12 or 13 years of age, he was just getting into some music lyrics that I thought were anti-life, anti-social, and certainly anti-gospel. He was getting into the music of Nirvana, if some of you can remember them, and Kurt Cobain. And he really had a thing for this group called Motley Crue, if some of you can remember them. And their lyrics were very anti-social and anti-life, apart from being anti-gospel. And rather than just jump on that, we tried to engage in dialogue, and we tried to listen to our kids. As our kids, our two older kids at the age of 12 and 13 and 14, wanted open discussion about why Kurt Cobain took his life, why Morrison of the Doors took his life, and talk about suicide and talk about those kinds of issues. So from a very early age, we try to encourage that kind of open discussion. The three things that Steve said he would want me to do over again were these. He said that I never put him down. Now, obviously, as I was hearing this for the first time, I was on edge, and it was good to hear him say that, because I think I had deliberately tried to make sure that I didn't. He said that he would want me to exercise over again the unwavering devotion that I model to the kids in my love for Helen. He gave an illustration of this the first time we did this seminar, and it was an illustration that he was kind of disappointed about in one sense, but very grateful about in another sense. When he was at school, and he went to a Christian school until year 10, and he went to a state school for years 11 and 12, which we were happy about because we wanted him to make the decision then. But at this Christian school, when he would talk with his mates said that they talked about discovering porn magazines in their father's desks, in their father's drawers of their desks, and hidden behind bookshelves. And Steve felt very out of the conversation because he could never find any at his place. It indicates to me that he probably looked. And so you don't know what they're looking at and what they're looking for. You don't know what they're doing when you're not home. But he wouldn't have found any either, because there were none there to find. But let me say, that does not let me off the hook. I have struggled with sexual temptation. I have struggled with sexual sin. I have struggled with lust and sexual sin of the mind. My mind has not been stimulated by porn magazines, but that doesn't mean to say that you can't stimulate your mind with the wrong kind of images. I've been exposed, probably just as you have been, to the soft porn that we see in MA movies and sometimes even in M movies, and you can still create images of your mind of nudity. You don't need the magazines to do it. And I have been guilty of those things. I am not squeaky clean, although in practice, by God's grace, I have avoided any actual going through with adultery. Although I would want to say that I have failed in my mind. And so there is guilt that I've asked forgiveness for, and there is guilt and there are issues that I still need to ask forgiveness for. The third thing that Steve said that he would want me to do over again is that he was glad that I kept the bad things that he did in perspective. This is the illustration that he gave, and by the way, each time I do this, I talked to Steve, and I talked to him again last night, and a number of years ago he said to me, I'm happy for you to go public on any of these issues. He said, if it will help other men, I'm happy for you to sort of open a kind of a window on our family life. So I wouldn't be telling you what I'm about to tell you if I didn't have Steve's permission to do so. And if Steve was here, he would be telling you these things himself for the sake of ministry and for the sake of helping others. The example he gave of me keeping bad things in perspective was in 1993. He was born in 1977. He was 15 years of age. He had sourced from some marijuana from his friends at a Christian school. And he was smoking pot. Not often, but he was experimenting with pot. When he was high one afternoon, and Helen and I were not at home, when he was high, he grabbed my push bike, rode it down to the local service station, went into the service station on a high, and just stole some magazines. Came out of the service, he didn't even try and do it subtly, he was just on a high, grabbed the magazines, ran out, and rode the bike away. In riding the bike away, he ran over a neighbour's lawn and came off the bike, jumped up and ran away. The neighbour confiscated the bike. So he was in a dilemma. He didn't know what he was going to do about getting the bike back. And so he had to come clean when firstly Helen came home and then when I came home. And even before I got home, Helen dealt with it in this way. We went back to the neighbour and apologised to the neighbour. He apologised to the neighbour to get the bike back. And Helen took him back to the service station to give the magazines back and to pay for any damage that came to the magazines. And so he had to eat humble pie in that sense and apologise to the guy who ran the service station, who just happened to be Paul Langmack, who played for the Bulldogs, for the Magpies and then the Bulldogs for I don't know how many years. And Steve was so chuffed that he got a lecture from Paul Langmack about doing drugs that he thought the whole thing was a fairly positive thing for him to experience. So we had to deal with that as well as the marijuana. We grounded him and we talked through the implications of doing drugs and drug abuse, but we didn't make it the worst crime in the world. We tried to keep it in perspective, and within 2 or 3 days after he was grounded for the weekend, life got back to normal. And he looks back appreciating the balance that we tried to deal with. The things that I would do over again, I'm into the third quarter now, the things that I would like to do over again, I would like to do differently if I had my time over again, are these. I'm a surfer. My father is a fisherman. The fishing genes jumped a generation. I think that fishing is a complete and total waste of time. But Steve loves fishing. Loves spending time with his grandfather, or did when his grandfather was well enough to fish. I fished with him occasionally, but I probably gave the impression that it was a bit of an imposition and a crimp on the fun that I wanted to have in life. I wish, looking back, I had taken more genuine interest in the things that he liked to do. I secondly wish that I had been more of a friend to Steve's friends. We tried to have an open home in terms of the friends of our kids coming into our home, and I think that's a good and positive thing to do. But I think there is a couple of situations where I wish that I had just tried harder at being a friend to some of his friends, because as I look back, they didn't have very good role models of fathers. And I could have been more helpful to them, and I think I missed that ministry opportunity. The third thing that I would do differently is, notwithstanding what I said earlier about holidays, I wish we had taken more holidays together. In the years 93, 94, and 95, when our two older kids were in years 11 and 12, we tended to stay at home rather than go away on holidays, because our older daughter did the HSC in 94 and our son did it in 95. And I took 1 week's holiday in each of those 3 years. And I really regret it. Because now when, well, even when I tried to take those outstanding holidays, the kids were grown up and they'd moved on, and they could have been good weeks that we could have shared together, and I missed out on it. I really regret that. The three things that Steve would have wanted me to do over again, or would want me to do over again if we had the chance. These are the things that he says. You ready for the dirt? He wished that I was more honest, that I had been more honest and more transparent regarding my struggles in life, about the things that I struggled over as a man. He wished, secondly, that I had accepted him more as someone who wasn't a macho man. These are his words. The illustration that he gives about this is that he came home one night as about an 18-year-old, absolutely torn to pieces, because he had broken off a relationship with his girlfriend and he had hurt her badly. And he came home and we could see that he was distraught. And it was about 11 o'clock at night and we just sat around and talked about it. And through his tears, he just tried to say how he felt. And we tried, as we'd always tried, to help him see that we wanted him to treat the girls in his life with great care and great respect. And I said to him, somewhere during the conversation, I tried to say it as a compliment. I tried to say, Steve, you really are a soft guy. I thought I was affirming him, and it crushed him, because it reinforced for him his perception that my perception of him was that he was not a macho man. I hadn't placed expectations on him in terms of sport, any at all. He played soccer one year. He played rugby league the next year. He played Australian rules the next 2 years. And these were at his initiative. Well, we talked it through. I think probably the first year at soccer when he was only 11, he wanted to do it. We wanted him to do it. And then when we moved back to Sydney from Kiama at the end of 92, in 93 he said he wanted to do a season of rugby. Now, of all the sporting codes that I love, and I love them all, I just love anything associated with a ball or anything associated with water, except fishing. Anything associated with the water that starts with S. Yeah, that's right. And snorkeling and surfing and all those other things. But rugby is the thing that was dearest to my heart, and I obviously conveyed that. He said at the age of 15 he'd love to have a year at rugby, so he went and we joined him up with the Burraneer Buccaneers, I think they were called, down near Cronulla, and he had a season in the under-16s. Played on the wing, he was fairly small of stature, and I think that was the place where they tried to put him so he wouldn't get hurt. And my heart was always in my mouth as they'd put up bombs and these big 16-year-olds on steroids would come descending down on him, and he'd bravely take the ball and disappear into about 8 huge bodies. And it was always a relief to see him stand on his feet afterwards. He told me some years later that he played rugby that year for me. I'd never asked him to. I'd never come close to verbalising my desire that he might. But there was this deeply ingrained desire to please me. And he knew that that would be one way of pleasing me. And it was, because I was delighted that he was having a year of rugby. We just endlessly, for that year, threw torpedo passes to each other in the backyard. They were great times of bonding. And it made me realise just how deeply our children long for our acceptance and our affection and our affirmation. He played rugby that year for me. That was his illustration that he wanted me to be, to see him more of a man's man or a macho man, and his fear that I didn't see him like that, and his fear that he might have disappointed me. To my pride and to my shame, about 2 years ago, surfing together, we caught the same wave. And as we were enjoying this wave together up at Noosa Heads, I was filled with this enormous sense of pride that we weren't only surfing together, but we were surfing on the same wave. And I also felt this enormous shame that I felt this pride. And I think I'm wondering whether subliminally I may still be giving off the aura that there are certain things that I want him to do to win my affirmation when I don't want him to do anything but just to be who he is. The third thing, and I finish with this, he says this. He would have wished that I would have stopped more often to know and be known. He says that he wished that I would have stopped more often to know and be known. Well, whether I've given and left, what kind of a legacy I've left for my family, only history will tell. But there it is, warts and all, the positive and the negative, as I've tried to be as honest with you as I can, and I've shared the heart of my son, who is not here today, and who is now a father in his own right with a 12-month-old daughter and seeking to build a legacy for another generation.